Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the AfriCast. My name is Brendan Lotz, and joining me today is Clinton Matos.
Hello, everybody.
And Robin Lichetti.
Hey, how's it going?
How are you guys doing this week?
Sweaty. It's very hot.
I mean, it's been raining all week, though.
It's still been hot, though.
Yeah, okay. All right. Robin, how are you doing?
I'm counting the days until the end of the year.
On that note, we actually got a nice little delivery this week from the folks over at Gamefinity. Do you just want to chat about that, Robin?
So as you may or may not know, Gamefinity is the local distributor for PlayStation and a lot of Sony assets in South Africa. And we were graciously given a PlayStation 5 for review. Like I said, we've been anxiously awaiting the next-gen console from Sony. And yeah, now we have one in for review. We have done an unboxing video, kind of taking a look inside the packaging, what's available there on that front, and also done a few nice glamour shots in gallery of images about the new PS5. Which, also I should mention that we got the 825 gigabyte version with the Ultra HD Blu-ray optical drive. So that's not the digital edition. The digital edition, interestingly, I also mentioned this in our video, is that the digital edition, the packaging is actually black and the optical drive version is white. So that's an easy way, I guess, to tell the difference when you once you eventually spot one of these things in a physical retail environment, which will only probably be next year anyway. But plenty of PS5 related content in the coming days and weeks.
So people might be confused because the PlayStation 5 launches next week to the public, but the Xbox Series X and Series S, those are still difficult to say. They're out already in the public. We don't have one. That's a whole nother story. We'll get into it at another time, but
you know what the problem is? Don't have a kitten.
What?
We had a kitten, and then they would have sent us one, I think.
Yeah, let's not get into that.
Let's just deviate like very quickly. Let's shift the conversation.
I'm being very controversial. I don't mind.
Yeah, no. I agree with you. I agree with you, Robin. I do. So next week we will have a full review out of the PlayStation 5. Be sure to check out our unboxing video. One thing that I do want to mention from that is that I really appreciate Sony including an HDMI cable in the box. I know that sounds like such a simple thing, but if I had to tell you how many times I've had to search for a HDMI cable, an extra one that works... it's just really nice that they included one in the box. I am curious though, Robin, do you know if it's HDMI 2.1 compatible?
That I'm actually not too sure. I'll have to look that up. What I can say is that you're going to need your Weet-Bix.
Oh, yeah.
And you're going to need a screwdriver because it is a big boy. It is not light at all.
It's very, very big.
Before we go on to the next topic, Robin, how's that controller with that weird, I don't know what you'd even call it, like micro mesh of symbols on the wings of the controller? It looks very weird, but people have said it's great.
So I like the feel of it. I'm not too sure whether the texture will eventually disappear after a few months and years of use. But I actually find it a bit odd. The actual controller itself, it's a bit, I guess, thicker than the DualShocks we've known. The actual in-hand feel is a bit different. I don't feel like I can grip it as nicely as I normally would over the DualShock 4 or DualShock 3. Also, and the thumbsticks, they're a lot smaller as well. They're more, I guess, akin to what you saw with the Xbox, the Elite controllers. It'll take a little time to get used to. But I'm prepared to put in the man hours to do so.
What a sacrifice.
A noble cause, Robin, a noble cause.
Really taking one for the team.
Clinton, moving on. Yeah. You have some news about DSTV.
Yes, they've also got, I was going to say, a new console. They've also got something new out. Very strangely, they've launched a new Explorer, the Explorer Ultra, right in the middle of new consoles launching in South Africa. I don't really understand the logic behind this because, as I'm going to discuss now, they've got a lot of features which the consoles also have. And even if there wasn't this overlap in hardware and capability, people just probably won't have the money to buy both. So they'll have to choose. It's very weird that they'll launch it now. But like I said, this is the DStv Explorer Ultra. And the three big features here are 4K support, Dolby Atmos audio support, and Netflix. Yes, that's right. DStv, which, you know, makes most of its money from subscription fees for its TV services, now supports a different subscription. It's very odd, but
I
understand why they're doing it. Yes,
Brent? I just want to put a pin in this for one second. Didn't DStv, like last year, just slam Netflix and say that it's a terrible service and they must be taxed and et cetera, et cetera? Now they're working with them.
Is that the exact quote, Brendan? You
it
don't
wasn't
know.
The exact quote. Okay. I'm paraphrasing here. But I mean, it's just like we went from slamming them to working with them in a matter of 6 months. Did the opinion change? Or
What's the saying? If you can't beat them?
That's
the first time that kind of thing has happened. I mean,
as I was going to say, I think this is just DStv basically bowing, not to pressure from Netflix, because Netflix probably doesn't even know DStv is, like, to be 100% honest, even though they do have an official partnership and there's quotes from Netflix saying DStv is good, whatever. On the whole, I'm sure Netflix is like, whatever. But DStv is probably saying, customers ask us for this probably every day on social media.
Yeah.
Here it is, right? And you can, if you get one of these decoders that supports Netflix, you can actually put your Netflix subscription fee on your DStv bill. Now, I'm not sure how the money works there. I'm not sure if DStv gets a percentage of that. But it's one of those things where, you know, DStv just wants to, I don't want to say entrap, but they want to bundle everything together. I mean, the whole point of TV, traditional TV, is bundling channels together and selling them off as a subscription. So in a way, it makes sense, but it's basically, you know, in bed with the enemy. Let's talk about pricing really quick. The box costs $2,499, excluding installation. If you get installation directly from DStv, that price goes up quite a lot to $3,699, which is $1,200 more. I haven't paid for DStv installation in a long time, but I kind of remember them being advertised for about R1,000. So this seems in line with everything. And I just want to quickly go over DStv's premium, which includes almost everything they offer. It's still very expensive with R749 a month. So if you're getting this decoder and the subscription, it's a hell of a lot of money. But I'm sure most people looking at the Explorer Ultra are probably people who have already been using DStv for years. And they're probably just going to consider this an upgrade. And I also want to mention that Netflix in South Africa costs between R99 and R169, depending on your level of subscription. So, yeah, there's a new set-top box, a new decoder, whatever you want to call it, from DStv. And they are jumping in bed with the enemy because they kind of have to get on with the changing times. I don't know. There's a whole other discussion. Maybe it will be a topic for a podcast one day, but I don't know how much longer DStv is going to be relevant. But then I remember that internet is still wildly expensive in South Africa. And then I think, oh, they're probably going to be around for a hell of a long time. So yeah, that's the new Explorer Ultra. I'll provide links to that along with everything else at the bottom of the story. And if you really want one, you can go to their order page and buy it.
Cool. Before we get into the meat and potatoes of this week's AfriCast, I just wanted to touch on a game I've been playing. It's another Ubisoft title. It is, of course, Assassin's Creed Valhalla, which sees you playing as a Viking. And so far, I'm quite enjoying my time with the game. I haven't penned a full review just yet because these games are massive. And our review code only came through very late before embargo lifted. So we've been playing it. Unfortunately, as this week has been a bit of a big one in terms of gaming. Destiny released Beyond Light, and then Assassin's Creed Valhalla was out. So I've been sharing my time equally between the two games. And Valhalla is quite impressive so far. Obviously, you play as a Viking. Ivor, as the character is known, you can play as male or female, though I am going to say, without
going into too much detail that you should probably play the male version of Ivor. If you want to play as the female, go for it. The story is going to be exactly the same. There's very little difference in terms of dialogue. In fact, I don't think there's any difference in terms of dialogue as regards Ivor. But yeah, there are reasons that you should play the male Ivor. One of them is that the voice actor, Marcus Brunn, is Magnus Brunn, I believe his name is. Stands to be corrected.
Sounds like a Viking.
Yeah, his voice is perfect. Like, it reminds me so much of Travis Fimmel as Ragnar Lothbrok in the Viking series, but with his own sort of style to voicing a Viking. It's such a great, great experience to hear him and his voice acting. But beyond that, I mean, the game is quite fun so far. You are a Viking that has left Norway and arrived on the shores of England, where the sons of Ragnar Lothbrok are trying to take over the kingdom, and you join this fight. And there's a bit of politics. There's a bit of fun. There are a ton of mini games. There is a lot of exploration, and so far I don't want to call it too early because I still have quite a few more hours to put into this game, and hopefully by the end of the weekend I'll have put in enough time. But I think that this might be one of the best Assassin's Creed games to come out ever. But yeah, it so far it has knocked my socks off. I'm really enjoying playing the game and going back to it every single day, discovering new things, unlocking new skills, unlocking new abilities, playing the mini games, doing the missions, just enjoying being a Viking. Really, it sounds silly, but some of the things that you do throughout the game are just so engaging. Even simple things like exploring the world for treasures and secrets. Like, just last night, I spent about an hour trying to find the entrance into a secret crypt. And it was so much fun because while I was doing that, I was being attacked by enemies. And then you get distracted and, oh, here's a world event that I can participate in and it'll give me something cool. So there's a lot to do. It's a really vibrant world that Ubisoft has created here. And England is massive. It's really, really big. Probably not as big as Odyssey, but I have heard reports that the game is much longer than Odyssey, which is nice because when I finished that game again recently and I rolled credits on the best ending, I was like, oh, this was a lot shorter than I remember it being. But yeah, Assassin's Creed Valhalla is currently impressing the socks off of me, and yeah. It's quite good so far.
Just one quick one, though. Mm-hmm. As far as, I guess, the Assassin's Creed lore and mythos,
yes,
have those kind of elements been pushed aside a little bit, and now Ubisoft are kind of favoring making these almost like their own contained kind of stories?
So, to an extent, yes, and to an extent, no. So, with Odyssey, there was less of a focus on the assassin side of the game and more a focus on being a mercenary for hire. And I don't think the assassins were mentioned at all, aside from like the old ones and the hidden ones and the ancient ones and all that sort of stuff. But they weren't really like explored in depth, which makes a degree of sense because I think that game was one of the earlier in the Assassin's Creed timeline. So it makes a degree of sense. Here, however, in Valhalla, there is quite a big emphasis on the assassin and the Assassin's Creed and the assassin bureaus and, as they call themselves, the hidden ones in this game. So there is a bit more of a focus on it. You do still travel into present day with Leila Hassan, but those moments are a little bit shorter, the ones that I've encountered, than previously with Odyssey. So that's nice. There is a bit more of a focus on assassins here and that whole sort of lore that they've been building up since the first game. And there's also a mention or kind of a throwback to the first game. If you played the first Assassin's Creed, you'll remember some of the things that come up there. So, I mean, it is still a very big focus for Ubisoft, but I don't think it's the main focus here. I think that they are trying to explore different ways of incorporating that Assassin's storyline into the game. And this in this game, it's done really, really well. It's not tiresome. It doesn't feel forced. It's just really well done.
So before we go on, Brendan, I have a question. I actually have two questions. Is Michael Fassbender in it?
No, he's not.
And the other one is, what is the microtransaction?
So I haven't had a need to unlock microtransactions. I will say this, however, is that when Ubisoft grants review code, do you want to just declare this for people to kind of also offer a peek behind the veil? Often what they'll do is they'll give you the deluxe version of the game, which gives you access to, I think it's usually the first year of content that comes out post-launch. That's your, what's it called? The season pass, as it were. Yeah. So we do get certain benefits from that. So for instance, we got the Berserker armor, which helped a lot right out of the gate. And we do get some Helix credits. But as far as I can tell, the time saver stuff is not active as part of the season pass. I don't know if you can buy it because I haven't been able to check microtransactions before the game was released, and it hasn't crossed my mind to check since then. I will check this weekend, though, as part of my review, and that will form part of my final thought. But I will say that I don't feel like I'm being gated like a lot of people felt they were in Odyssey as regards earning of XP. Like, I'm leveling up quite fast. I'm unlocking skills a lot easier. And one of the main things is that you don't unlock skills through experience. You unlock abilities through experience, and skills you unlock in the world by stumbling across them. Like, a book of knowledge is what they're called, and you unlock different skills through that. And then your abilities you unlock through XP. And these are things like increase damage with your primary attack, or unlock the ability to have better time swings. So if you are attacking and you hit a certain beat of attacks, you'll continue attacking in like a string of combos. So I don't feel like I'm being kneecapped, and there doesn't seem to be any additional stuff happening in terms of earning XP. And yeah, overall, I think that the microtransactions are really going to be cosmetics. I think there will be time savers. I can't comment right now. If you want to buy a time saver, I mean, go for it. But I don't feel that it's a necessary purchase like it might have been with Odyssey.
Cool.
Right. Now we're going to talk about something else that was announced this week. Apple held its One More Thing event on Tuesday evening, which I always found funny because that's Apple's kind of shtick is, oh, and one more thing, as they leave off, and lots of other people have copied that. But this week, Apple announced its new silicon in the form of its M1 system on chip. Robin, you covered that news, so do you want to start us off with an overview of what Apple announced?
Yeah, so as you kind of mentioned, this is their new silicon, which is specifically aimed towards their Mac devices. So your iMac, although there wasn't a new one announced, iMac, your MacBooks, your Mac Minis, so anything with the word Mac in it, it will probably be running M1 or something similar in the future. And as Apple kind of alluded to in the beginning of their presentation, it's this M1 has been a long time in the works, a few years now already. And it's not new for Apple to be kind of be going the route of doing their own silicon. They've been doing so for their iPhones and their wearables, the Apple Watch in recent years. And I guess this kind of brings that whole kind of ecosystem full circle. So the M1 chip, it's a 5-nanometer process, and they say that it can, well, it's packed with an estimated 16 billion transistors, which is a lot. There are, I guess various enhancements compared to, I guess, Intel Silicon that Apple are touting here. It depends on the devices that it's running on, so I guess we'll break them down a bit further into the podcast. But what Apple is saying is that this new M1 delivers 3.5 times faster CPU performance, 6 times faster GPU performance, and up to 15 times faster machine learning. It's also going to bring, in some cases, twice the amount of battery life compared to kind of previous generations of Mac devices that are running Intel Silicon. Again, Apple like to make a lot of claims during presentations, so we have to see what the actual real-life performance is like. But it seems like this new batch of silicon is very much being touted as machine learning focused and really designed for those kinds of tasks. Also, Apple mentioned that the M1 is going to be one of several iterations of silicon. It will be unveiling over the coming years. So I guess M1 is, a little teaser. So I think we'll probably allude to whether or not it should be looking to getting an M1 powered device a bit later. But yeah, I think that serves as a good kind of layup as far as what Apple showcased earlier this week.
So I do just want to highlight a few things here. Because Apple didn't really mention it during its presentation when it was touting up its 2x faster, 25% of the power. It didn't mention what it was comparing those things to. But over on Apple's website, it does. And just to give you an idea of what Apple is comparing its M1 chips to, it's a 3.6 gigahertz quad-core Intel Core i3-based Mac Mini. Then a... Where's the other one here? i3-based Mac Mini. Yeah, so it seems like Apple is using a lot of its performance claims or basing them on a Core i3-based Mac Mini, which are Intel-powered. Well, they were. They aren't anymore. So yeah, just to give you guys an idea of what, when we say 3x or 2x performance, we're comparing it to a Intel Core i3, which I don't think that's really a fair comparison, because I mean, those are really low end chips that, to my mind, are probably better suited for things like Chromebooks and that sort of thing.
I thought,
yeah, it's the kind of stuff you kind of find in those like entry-level Asus stuff.
Yeah.
I thought we kind of moved past the i3 entirely, and now it was i5, i7, i9.
Well, no, they are. I mean, they still have i3s. They still have
Celerons. I know they still have them, but I was like, I thought we all agreed not to use them anymore.
Yeah,
kind of like the Celeron and the Duos, who are like, we don't do that here.
So I think one of the things that – well, let's start this discussion, because I don't want to jump around too much. I think I want to start off by going and kind of highlighting why Apple has decided to make this move. It's no secret that Intel has lagged behind in terms of architecture and chip design. We saw AMD absolutely trounce them with the release of the latest AMD Ryzen 5000 CPUs. With, I think it's the 5950X, just absolutely dominating performance charts. And Apple, I think they've been getting the short end of the Intel stick for a long time now. We've seen so many reports when a new Mac launches about how bad the thermals are and how low the performance is. And I get it, right? I mean, these chips run really, really hot, and then Apple is putting them into the absolutely tiniest chassis, which, I mean, if Intel is saying that you can do that, and we have seen notebooks that are thinner than Macs in the wild, and you just have to wonder, like, why do these things run so hot? And beyond that, I mean, Intel's still running on a 10-nanometer process,
10++++.
Yeah, I mean, it's technically a 14 nanometer process, but they've made improvements to it. So it's now similar to a 10 nanometer. We don't know when they're going to go with 7. I mean, there's rumors that Rocket Lake might be that, but those are just rumors at the moment. So Intel has kind of lagged behind, and now as a result, Apple's kind of gone, well, we can do better. And performance right now, from what we've seen in terms of just pre-release, seems to be up there. I mean, it seems like they've created a really decent performing chip. Of course, however, this all relies on real-world usage, because it's all good and well for Apple to say, oh, well, we've got 2x CPU performance. Okay, in what? In a benchmark, because that's synthetic and many people aren't ever going to run Geekbench. You know, like, what's the CPU performance faster in? Is it in Premiere Pro? Is it in Final Cut? Where are we getting this performance? And I think that's where Apple might lose a bit of consumer confidence if these claims don't really back up, which leads me to my next point. And that is compatibility. So, Robin, you have a Mac at the moment.
I do indeed. A Mac.
Okay, so are you interested in these Macs to a point where you would buy one on launch day, fresh out the box?
That's an interesting question. Robin, the tech journalist, is very interested to kind of see what these new devices are all about. Robin, the consumer who has dealt with a chaotic 2020 and has no disposable income, is not interested in buying new Macs with the M1 chip. So I kind of understand your question in that, but at the same time, I also think that the more general consumer isn't buying, you know, isn't necessarily worried about what silicon is inside.
Yeah.
And again, I might be generalizing here, but a person that's buying an Apple device isn't necessarily buying it for the silicon. They're quite happy to defer to Apple and let them do as they see fit.
So
again, I might be generalizing here.
No, but I mean, that's what this is. I mean, we have to generalize because we're trying to account for everything. So my concern for the general consumer who doesn't care what silicon is inside the latest Mac, my concern is compatibility with applications. Now, we do need to posit this by saying that Apple does have this this concern in the back of its mind. It has released, what was it called, Clinton? Universal Binary.
Yeah, Universal Binary 2.
Universal Binary 2, as well as Rosetta 2, which allows you to run applications that aren't yet primed for the x86 architecture of these new M1 chips so that you can run applications. So, for instance, Apple uses an example of Fusion 360. So, while Fusion 360 might not have a compatible x86 application, Rosetta 2 should allow it to run. Now, we say should because we don't know. And in the past, with the original Rosetta, there were some issues that were highlighted. Excuse me. But my concern now is that Apple is touting or is selling now a MacBook Pro. And when I hear the word Pro at the end of a product, I think professional. This is for prosumer. This is for somebody that's going to use it for professional applications, whether that's graphic design, desktop publishing, whatever it may be. And now you're asking them to take a leap and hope that their applications are going to work here. I don't think that that's a leap of faith that I would be willing to take if I was a pro. Oh.
Yeah, 100%. Clinton, I'm also a bit confused in terms of this compatibility, that these two laptops are so similarly spec, but one, as you said, is pro and the other one is just a regular MacBook.
Yeah, I mean, that's I didn't even mention that, is that all of the Macs are running the exact same spec now. They're running a M1 chip with up to 16 gigs of RAM. You can't have more than 16 gigs of RAM, and an 8-core CPU.
Which is really low for
professional applications. 16 gigs is nothing. It's nothing. You're running on Windows at least. 16 gigs lets you run Windows and a couple of applications. If you want to start getting into real sort of like CAD design, graphic design, 16 gigs doesn't get you very far.
So I also wanted to mention, again, to harp on the thing that people don't really care. I think that, you know, you're saying people aren't going to open Geekbench, which I agree with. I think if people just buy this and it runs like Chrome and, I don't know, Zoom and maybe Word and it runs it fine, people will be like, yeah, this is the same computer I got the other day. Like Robin said, they're going to defer to the wisdom of the people who are selling it to them, which is never a good idea. You never trust a salesman. If they have a MacBook now or they have some kind of laptop they want to replace with an Apple device, they're going to go to the website. They're going to go into the App Store, into the Apple Store and be like, what laptop do you have that can fit in my price range? Or just, I have a lot of money, give me a laptop. They aren't even going to know that it's got an M1. They'll say, well, what's this? I don't know what this is. And they're going to download Chrome, and Chrome's going to work fine because they've probably worked with Google, and Zoom's going to work fine because they've probably worked with Zoom. I'm just guessing here because those are some of the most popular applications. And then they're not going to care about the rest. But again, like I said, that flies in the face of the whole Pro moniker. I don't know if the people who buy the Pro laptops, notebooks, are going to be picking this generation up because of compatibility. But I think the regular MacBook is going to sell just fine.
The MacBook Air, yeah.
I can probably just weigh in here because I've got a 13-inch Pro that I'm currently using. It's got Intel silicon in it.
Yeah.
And looking at the trio of Mac devices that were shown off, my interest is only peaked in the MacBook Air, which I think could be, provided your budget is good enough, a nice student laptop. Student notebook, and then the Mac Mini, which could be good for, say, a remote working setup. I don't, like you guys have mentioned, I don't foresee a lot of people, at least people that are aware of what the M1 is all about, picking up the Pro, 13-inch Pro right now. If down the line Apple have an M2 or M3 that is vastly superior, that's when I think it'll hold more value as far as the Pro lineup goes.
So speaking of students, I actually want to talk about that because recently the National Student Fund announced that they had completed a tender process to provide laptops to students. And before I announce the price of those, Brendan, can you just take us through the prices of these? And then I'll chime in at the end to compare them to how much people are looking at spending on student laptops.
Cool. Okay, so the Apple MacBook Air, let me just bring this up. Yes, I do want to open this link. Okay, so the Apple MacBook Air costs $24,999. The Apple MacBook Pro costs $29,999. And the Apple Mac Mini with the M1 chip is $17,999. This is all for the 512 gigabyte SSD version. That's the price. So it's $24,999. $29,999 and $17,999 for the Mac Mini.
Okay, so back in the real world, where students are actually looking at laptops, again, the NSFAS, I don't know how you pronounce it, they completed the tender. They went with five bidders. The cheapest laptop, now, you know, I will be plain here, it's a laptop and a laptop bag. For some reason, they put a stipulation here where it has to be all-inclusive, where it's a laptop and a bag, and the bag needs to be made in South Africa. But I really don't think that's a huge amount of money, maybe like 200 Rand. So, you know, keep that in the back of your mind, even though it's not going to make up the difference here. The cheapest one was 3,863 Rand, right? The most expensive one was 6,200. So these MacBooks are many, many, many times more expensive. Now, I'm getting in touch with NSFAS. I'm waiting for a reply about what the specs of these laptops are. You know, give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe these Rand amounts that were released in the tender documents were cost price, right? And if you compare them to something you can buy, they'll be better, I was going to say better quality. There'll be better value because if it's cost price, you can obviously get something more expensive because you're paying less. We don't have those details here yet, but I just wanted to highlight these numbers because this is what students are looking at because they're probably going to be funded through NASFAS and they're probably going to be getting their student loans, their funding from there. So when I don't want to like discredit what Robin said, if you're a student, you're going to be looking at the Air. You're going to be a very affluent student looking at the MacBook Air. These numbers that I just mentioned, that's much more in line with the amount of money people actually have to spend.
So,
for sure, I mean, don't get me wrong. Apple, we've always known, is a very premium brand.
Yeah.
Sorry, I should have prefaced that maybe.
No. It's assumed.
So I do also just want to mention something else that Apple kind of didn't mention explicitly, though, I mean, it's mentioning it. It's just using its own Apple marketing spin. In terms of memory or upgradability of these laptops, that's not going to happen. The RAM and the CPU are unified, so they essentially on one chip. So you're not going to be able to add RAM. You need to buy a iteration of the MacBook that has as much RAM as you think you're going to need in future, which, as we mentioned, is up to 16 gigs. And there's no upgrade path here. I don't believe that you can upgrade the SSD either. So the most you're going to get is a 512 gigabyte SSD. Now, one other thing that wasn't mentioned, and this actually makes me a little bit angry, is that there's no support for external GPUs for any of these Macs. They do Brandon, not support external GPUs.
I was going to ask you about that because now, people have also been speaking about the Thunderbolt connection.
Yeah.
I was going to say, you can't upgrade it, but maybe you can just connect the GPU to it, which again...
You cannot. So the problem here is that... Okay, so GPUs are these days pretty much just really beefy CPUs. I'm dumbing this down a lot, but it's best to think of it that way for what I'm about to say. So if you are somebody who's using a CAD program and you have an external GPU on your desk, which contains a Quadro or the new RTX professional cards, if you have one of those, it's now useless if you buy a Mac with it. And that sucks because GPU processing for things like CAD is just better than relying on a CPU. Now, I'm not the biggest fan of NVIDIA, but I will concede that NVIDIA's professional grade cards are among the best in the industry. I mean, they're used in data centers. They are being used for self-driving technology, for artificial intelligence applications, high-performance computing, supercomputers use them. There's a reason that they do that. And that's because the architecture, the technology within those graphics cards is very good for those applications. Now, I think the Venn diagram of developers and scientists that also use Mac, who are also Mac users, is pretty much just a circle. For good reason, because many developers feel that Apple's security is a lot better, that Apple's ecosystem for developers is a lot better, and I can't deny that. But now you have a situation where you have a studio which has been using MacBooks, the same MacBooks for the last 4 years, that's now considering an upgrade. They're not going to be able to use Mac because none of these, you're not going to be able to use a new Mac because none of them have the capabilities that you're looking for, especially not support for external GPUs, which... I think it's safe to say pretty much every PC, Windows-based PC, allows support for. I don't think I've ever heard of a PC or Windows device rejecting an external GPU.
Maybe not external, but a lot of the times you can just open it and connect it right into the slot if that's a problem. But yeah also it's rare. And even though, you know, external GPUs felt like for a while the next the big thing, mm-hmm. And then people kind of got about it and support dropped. Well, it didn't drop. It just became less commonplace to hear about it. But because the technology was already invented, you can just pick it up whenever you want.
So,
I agree with you, Brandon. It's crazy that that's not included. And I think this links back to what I mentioned at the top. where this really feels like a, I don't want to say a bastard stepchild, but it feels like something that a lot of people will forget about soon. And they'll have version two and they'll be like, oh my God, look at all the things we invented. We invented an external GPU. We invented the ability to put more than 16 gigs of RAM. And people will be like, no, you didn't. But the people who are buying will be like, oh yeah, that's awesome. And I don't want to talk down to those people. It's just that's the nature of how Apple operates.
I mean, to be clear, I don't think that this is going to be a problem forever. I think that it's a problem right now if you want to be an early adopter. And I mean, this is something we've always said, is that if you're going to be an early adopter, you're going to lose, you're going to get burned in some ways. So I think that this is a problem that will eventually be solved once Apple has nailed down its foundry, its chip design and its process and all that sort of stuff. But right now, I think that you are taking a massive risk if you want to dive into this new Apple ecosystem.
So I wanted to speak to you guys about something else as well. I'm still not entirely sure why they decided to jump ship and do things themselves. Now, I understand from an all-in-one perspective, right? They want to do everything themselves, and maybe not out of, you know, ego, saying, you know, fine, I'll do it myself. But just because the more control you have over your business, the less you have to worry about other people, you know, not supplying things correctly or making mistakes, or if there's a scandal, then you don't need to worry about it affecting your business. I understand all of that. But if they were having problems with Intel, they looked at Intel and the last products they put out, and the laptops they made were overheating, whatever. First of all, why didn't they just design their laptops better? I don't want it to be like forehead, you know, just build. Why didn't you make it better? But why didn't they take the time to make the cooling better as one option? Why didn't they just go to AMD, you know, just maybe switch over entirely? Or why didn't they go to AMD and be like, hey, you make custom compute units for both of the consoles, just make us some custom compute units? I really don't understand why they didn't go any of those routes. And on top of all of this, the M1 isn't entirely made by Apple either, right? Mm. It's based off of tech from other companies. So in a way, they're still depending on a third-party manufacturer, well, third-party company, to do the engineering.
Mm.
So the whole thing just baffles me.
That company is ARM, just for reference. That company is ARM, which is now owned by NVIDIA. So
yeah, sorry, I thought we mentioned that earlier, but maybe we didn't. It's hot. My brain is all So yeah, I'm just baffled by these decisions. I'm baffled by a lot of decisions Apple makes, but at the end of the day, I look at them and I usually think, okay, it's probably just going to make you more money. But this one, don't necessarily think it will, because they put so much money into R&D. Yeah, so I'm just confused about the whole thing. I think they're such a big company. I don't want to say they're too big to fail, but the brand loyalty is so strong that they're going to make money regardless. It's just very confusing to me, and it seems like they're putting in a lot of effort for minimal returns. I don't know what you guys feel about that. Do you feel that they made the right decision? Should they have gone to AMD and said, make us a compute unit like you did for Xbox and Sony? What do you guys think about that?
So I can't speak to whether or not they should have spoken to another manufacturer for the silicon. But I do foresee, and I think I mentioned this to Brendan the morning after the announcements were made, is that this seems like a sly tactic from Apple to refresh a lot of their devices and now offer up several different SKUs as far as components go moving forward. So say, for example, the MacBook Air, there could be an M1 version, an M2 version, an M3 version. So it's essentially broadening their lineup even further, and potentially then means people will be more, I guess, willing to spend money because they have the different SKUs. I think it's a longer play than necessarily we are seeing right now.
And you, Brendan, what do you think about my wild theories?
So, I mean, I agree with you. I don't know why they didn't go to somebody like AMD, who has a long history. They have their own foundry. They have their own process. They're like, everything's kind of sorted. But I think that the reason they didn't do that is because of the issues that they've had with Intel. Like, I understand that they are using ARM to produce these chips, but I think they have a lot more control over it. And as we saw with the iPhone 12 earlier this year, with that launch, having control over everything from silicon to software is really beneficial for a company like Apple. For instance, one of the things that they talked up with the iPhone was being able to hone the 5G capabilities to such a point that they've created one of the better 5G antennas. Now, obviously, I can't speak to that until I have tested it for myself. But from what they have told us, it seems like they've made a better 5G solution than other companies might have, for instance.
Yeah.
And that makes sense because you don't have to deal with licensing. You don't have to deal with limitations, like that sort of stuff. It allows you to open up things or close things down, and it just gives you better control. So from that perspective, I can see why Apple did it. On the other hand, like you, Clinton, I am concerned that going into this business where you're now making all of your chipsets might come back to hurt them in a little while. And I say that because if you look at somebody like AMD, they have huge divisions dedicated to research and development of new technology. And AMD didn't arrive at its 7-nanometer chips by accident. It was a long, hard road where they were lambasted. And, I mean, there was the FX series along the way. I mean, it was not a good time for them. But if you look back at AMD, if you look back, I mean, just not even 10 years ago, let's go back to 2013. It was a joke. It was a joke to say, I'm going to build an AMD PC.
Yeah.
And it's taken that long to get to a point where now people are like, oh, you know what? I might just build a fully Team Red PC now. AI. But even now, Intel is still like one of the most popular chips on Steam for gamers. And while I understand what Apple is doing here, and it seems to have the performance figures to back it up, what happens in two generations' time?
Yeah,
like AMD is set to announce 5-nanometer next year. It's on their roadmap. Their roadmap seems to be going ahead. They set to release 5-nanometer. After that, I think it's going to be a game of who can improve on that further. But what does Apple do? You know, I mean, using ARM, which is great, but ARM is also limited. We've seen x86 fail before, and it was Microsoft where it failed with the Surface RT. And they tried for years to get that right, and eventually they couldn't get it right. Now, Apple's kind of forced it here, saying, if you want an Apple laptop, you got to buy M1.
Yeah.
And that might help them. That might help them now, today. But in 2 years' time, when Intel or AMD is far surpassing the capabilities of Apple Silicon, what happens then? And sorry, I am ranting a little bit. I do just want to mention one last thing, is desktop processors. So there is apparently a desktop processor in the works from Apple that has a higher TDP, total die power. But how is that going to perform? What is the cooling going to look like on that? What's upgradability going to look like on that? I mean, the Mac Pro is somewhat upgradable. It still uses regular SATA. It still uses regular PCIe. Like, there is some sort of upgradability there. But if you're using an ARM process and everything's embedded, what's that going to look like? Am I going to buy a Mac Tower and not be able to upgrade it? Like the old cheese grater from many years ago, where it was, I think it was Power PC that they were using.
Yeah. And another problem with the Mac Tower, like you said, if they are going to use the same silicon or an upgraded version for the desktop stuff, again, how is GPUs going to work?
Because
if you buy a Mac Tower right now, you can spec in an NVIDIA or probably a Quattro card or an AMD card. And it's a bit different, but it's the same consumer desktop GPU that you can get from these companies. Does ARM even support that? Is Apple going to have to build their own PCI Express system to now work with that? We don't know yet. And the answer might be maybe. Oh my gosh, I can't even think about how horrible it would be if you're going to take... Because again, ARM has always done mobile processing. That's their bread and butter. To take that tech and force it into a desktop environment doesn't seem like a good idea.
I'm sorry, could you imagine trying to reinvent PCIe?
Yeah, that sounds so terrible.
That sounds like an impossible task. Honestly, like I could not imagine having to re-spec a standard that has been standard for decades, literal decades, right? It's been improved upon, yes, but I mean, I can plug in a PCI 1.0 device into my PCI 4.0 slot right now and it will work. So if Apple's going to do that, I mean, it goes against everything that they do as far as I'm concerned.
Man, those wheels are going to come out real square.
But this is the thing, is that I do wonder if Apple has looked at the long term of this thing, because now it works, yes, but we've graduated to a point where, like, the days of PowerPC are no more. It is widely accepted that Intel and AMD are leading in the CPU space. If Apple can do it, great, but I just don't think that they can. I don't think you can compete with these bigwigs.
Do you know what would be hilarious? Everybody knows Intel is working on GPUs in the background, like in the dark when no one's looking. Can you imagine if they announce new desktops? This is Apple. They announce new desktops, and they're going to be like, guess what? Intel GPUs are exclusive to us. We've got a new interface system, a new kind of PCI, and they only work with Intel GPUs. You can't buy an Intel GPU and put them in your normal Windows machine. That would be hilarious. Like, we broke up with Intel in the CPU business, but now we're firm partners with GPUs.
Yeah.
That would be mad world, but it also wouldn't be that surprising considering we just live in an insane world right now.
Unfortunately for us, though, we're going to have to wait to see how these Apples perform in the real world. Because we just don't know at this point in time. We've seen some reports of benchmarks and single core process seems to be flying. But I mean, all of this is up in the air right now, and I don't doubt that people are going to buy these Macs. That's almost a given because the cult of Apple is strong. I do worry though that Apple's now kind of excluded its biggest market, which is prosumers. As much as I hate to admit it, as a lifelong PC fanboy, I think that Apple does do a good job with creative applications or developers or video editing, whatever it may be, they do it well. Will these M1 chips be able to carry on that tradition? I don't know. And Rosetta too, while it might work, let's not forget that adds a process to a workflow, and that is going to hit performance. And if you're converting a program from running on x64 to now x86, that is something that's going to hit your performance. You can't deny it. And unless there is leeway for that in these M1 chips, I'm worried, man. I'm worried.
I'm not. They're a billion-dollar company. That's a
trillion-dollar company.
I'm worried about the consumers who already have Apple and would prefer to buy them in the future.
Yeah.
But I'm not worried about Apple.
Robin, what are your thoughts before we wrap up here?
I think I would not advise buying an M1 chipped device at the moment. Like you guys have mentioned, there are still many lingering questions. The price is way up there.
Yeah.
And we don't really know what the real world performance is like yet. So
it's still cheaper than a Note 20 Plus Pro from Samsung, though.
Sure, but I can't use this as a notebook. it's just I do want to see what the second or third iteration or whatever the next batch of silicon is going to be like.
Yeah.
Before I would ever advise someone to purchase it. Like I mentioned, I'm interested in their performance from a tech journalism perspective, but as a consumer, it doesn't really make sense at the moment.
Robin, can I ask you just again before we wrap up? I've got another one before we wrap up. So you're on the quote-unquote old MacBook, the proper ones that work like regular PCs. If in the future, what if Apple says or does it on the slide that your regular x86 programs start maybe they start slowing down, maybe they stop working as well as they used to, and Apple says to you, hey, our ARM ones still work, they work great, come over to M1. How would you feel about that? Because Apple has been known for the old hardware to kind of go down when the new stuff comes out. It's been known to happen.
I hear what you're saying, especially on the mobile side of things. I would be really less than happy if it happened on the MacBook side of things, because as far as I'm concerned, MacBook is, yes, it's very expensive, but it's often a solid investment as far as the longevity of the device goes.
It just works.
If that's not happening, then I need to start looking at whatever Windows 10 notebooks that have great battery life are like.
I do want to just close on one thing here, and that is a positive thing. That if Apple gets this right, if it's able to make an ecosystem where you can use a desktop and you can use desktop applications on a what is essentially a mobile chipset, that could mean good things for smartphones, primarily from a professional point of view, from a gaming point of view, because I'm just thinking big picture here. Like, if they're able to seamlessly translate x64 to x86, if they're able to get that right in a way that doesn't impact performance too much, maybe we could start seeing like AAA games releasing on PlayStation 5, Xbox Series XS, and mobile. I mean, it's a reach. It's a reach.
Yeah.
I know that I'm reaching here, but I think that maybe we could see something like that where we now have smartphones that are capable, perhaps not on a performance-to-performance ratio, but are capable of running like AAA titles on your smartphone. Like, if that is something that Apple is able to do, I will be the first one to eat my words and start praying at the altar of Apple. But yeah, I mean, that is something that could foreseeably happen with this, is if they manage to get it right, of course, and that's a big if, we should say.
If this move ends up unifying an ecosystem for phones and desktop computers and notebooks, I'll be flabbergasted. Yeah. I'll eat so much humble pie.
Yeah.
That would be such a turn.
Because, I mean, that would quite literally be the biggest development in smartphones since they hit the scene. And we have seen it to some extent. We have seen smartphones kind of touting as, oh, it's like a PC. And I mean, Samsung's DeX gives you a desktop experience, although it's not really that comparable to an actual desktop. But if Apple gets this right, the shoe could be on the other foot. AMD and Intel could be like going to Apple going, hey, teach us your ways, please. Teach us, Sensei. But yeah, if they get it right, it's a big if, though. Although, if anybody is cocky enough to get it right, I think it's Apple.
Or foolhardy.
Yeah, foolhardy. There's probably a better word. But yeah, are you going to buy a new MacBook with an M1 chip? We're curious to know. Let us know on Twitter and Facebook if you're listening to this. And let us know your thoughts. We really, really want to know what the wider opinion is from folks who use Apples. It's an interesting time that we're living in. But that's going to wrap it up from us for this week. Next week, we will be looking a little bit more in depth into the PlayStation 5. So, in the build-up to that, we're going to make a bit of a request. If you want to know certain things about the PlayStation, what would you like to see? What sort of features would you like us to explore? Let us know on Facebook, Twitter. Give us your thoughts and we'll take them into consideration.
We'll do anything short of a durability test.
Yeah, we're not going to drop it. That's not happening. We're not dropping it. We're not going to test how well it works underwater. We're not going to pull a Linus Sebastian and try and water cool it.
To make it look like it's on fire, we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
We're also not going to do scale comparisons to kittens.
No, we're not going to do that. We're going to do some real stuff. So if you want to maybe see what the user interface looks like or know how well, how quickly games launch from it, like, let us know, and we'll gladly produce that content for you. We do have some features lined up. We're not going to let them or give them away too soon. But yeah, if you have anything additional that you want to see, let us know. But yeah, that's going to do it from us for this week. Thank you so much for joining me, Clinton Matos.
It's a pleasure, Brendan.
And Robin Chetty.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And thank you so much for tuning in to our listeners. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye, everybody.
Sorry, the number you have dialed is not in service at this time.